Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
It's here. It's all still here.
A miracle today in Durnsville, Indiana. Four women rescued from an underground apocalypse cult allegedly run by
self-proclaimed Messiah, Reverend Richard Wayne Gary Wayne.
So starts the Netflix original series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, a surprisingly dark comedy about a resolutely sunny woman who attempts to conquer life in New York after being held hostage for 15 years. Emmy-nominated actor Ellie Kemper stars as the naive, cheerful Kimmy Schmidt. Her upbringing in St. Louis was far from the bunker experience, however. Her new memoir is My Squirrel Days. From Kemper's days putting on holiday dramas in her parents' front hall to striking out at Saturday Night Live to starring in her own show, Kemper's here to share some of those stories and take a hard look at comedy today. This hour on Point, comedian and actor Ellie Kemper. We're happy to have you here now in studio, Ellie Kemper. As I said, the Emmy-nominated star of the Netflix original series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. You may also know her as Erin Hannon from The Office or as one of the co-stars of the 2011 movie Bridesmaids. Her new memoir titled My Squirrel Days comes out next week. You can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Ellie Kemper, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Me too. I would say, Ellie Kemper, why did you write this book? But you explain exactly right there and pages yes. Right in front of you why you wrote this book. Why didn't you share that with us? So okay. I'll ask you about it.
Okay. Okay. So this is an excerpt from my book.
How exciting is that to say?
Oh my gosh. Can you believe that? I've been waiting 10 years to say that. And now I said it.
Okay. You did.
There comes a time in every sitcom actress's life when she is faced with the prospect of writing a book. When my number was up, I told myself that I would not blink. I would fulfill my duty as an upbeat actress under contract on a television series and serve my country in the only way I knew how. I would cull from my life the very greatest and most memorable of anecdotes. I would draw on formative lessons learned both early on and also not too long ago. I would paint for the reader a portrait of the girl, the teenager, the woman I am today, and I would not falter. I would write a book.
And Ellie Kemper, you didn't falter. You did write a book.
I don't know if I didn't falter. I hope I didn't. I aimed not to falter. Thank you for telling me that.
So you it's a lot of fun. You've written for McSweeney's. You've written for The Onion. You, as well as doing all the stuff people know you for, you've really you like to write. But you're following a succession of such books. What influenced you in deciding to put this together?
I had been wanting to write a book for many years. I guess a lot of people think that they will write a book one day. But, of course, thinking about it and doing it are two totally different things. So I you know what actually I think made me put the pedal to the metal? That was the only saying that was in my head just now.
Yeah.
Put the pedal to the metal was I got pregnant and I realized, okay, I'm going to have a baby in July. If I don't seriously get to work on this book, I have no idea how my life's going to change come July. So I'm going to do as much as I can before, you know, my due date and try to get as much done as I can. And that really inspired me to get writing. And then, of course, I got, you know, so little done before he was born and so little done after he was born.
And so there's a nice consistency there. Squirrel Days, what do those refer to?
That refers to one of the central stories in my book, which is about my ultimately unsuccessful attempt to befriend a plump squirrel in my backyard. I definitely, you know—
St. Louis.
In St. Louis, Missouri. I had human friends, too, but I had just seen Dances with Wolves, and I was obsessed with the idea of trying to commune with nature and be one with the animals. And so that's what prompted that, you know, foray into squirrel bonding.
And why did it fail?
Because the squirrel had no interest in being my friend for some reason. And I think it reached its peak when I fell from a tree. I don't know if I was trying to impress. Oh, the squirrel had a name, Natalie.
Lovely name for a lovely squirrel.
Yes. I fell off a tree and I turned around and Natalie was laughing at me. And how could I tell she was laughing at me? Because I was one with the squirrels. But I knew that it was sort of a cruel laughter. And I realized in that moment that nature is indifferent to us. And, you know, we better respect it. That's a larger point I'm trying to make.
This was the thrust of the book, Eliot's a Squirrel, is basically what you're saying. Yes. What, you know, there have been a number of books by prominent women comedians lately. What did you want to convey? What did you want people to come out of it with?
Yeah. I feel like I may have set myself up for an impossible task because I wanted to write a collection of personal essays without getting too personal. So that's hard to do. And so many of these ladies who have written these brilliant books that are both so funny and also very truth-telling, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to try to do my own take on this genre, I guess. And so, I don't know. I read all those books many times. And I hope I came up with something that was unique to me, but, you know, who knows if I did.
One of the things that comes through is, you know, you enjoy dramatic. You used to perform plays for your parents and family members in the hallways, and you really wanted to get into comedy and for a bunch of different avenues, writing. You know, you tried you did apply and audition for Lorne Michaels at Saturday Night Live. Tell me how that went.
Well, I did not get a part on Saturday Night Live through no fault of my own. No, I'm kidding. I shouldn't have gotten a part on Saturday Night Live. I can't do celebrity impressions. But I think, first of all, so many people have put on plays. I don't mean to sound like I'm the only person who ever put on a play in her basement. I mean, so many people do and hold their poor parents hostage as they put on these endless, endless shows. And I was one of those kids. But I auditioned for Saturday Night Live using some characters that I had been performing in a showcase from the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which is an improv theater. At the time, it was just in New York. And, you know, it was interesting. I don't know if this is always the case. They don't call you to say you didn't get it, the part. They just never call you.
They just leave you hanging.
Yeah. I mean, unless you got a part on the show, then they do call you. But I think like after a month, I guess after the show started airing, I realized, I didn't book a part.
So when did you feel like you'd finally hit it? Was it The Office or was it something else?
For sure, The Office. And in fact, not getting a part on Saturday Night Live turned out to be just fine because I think that having my name in the mix of people who had auditioned, it brought my name to the attention of other producers. And I got to meet with Mike Schur and Greg Daniels like about 2 months after my failed attempt to be on Saturday Night Live.
And what was supposed to be a temporary gig turned out to be something a lot more enduring. In the season 6 episode Secretary's Day of the Office, Michael, the main character played by Steve Carell, reveals to your character, Erin, that her boyfriend was previously engaged to one of their coworkers. In the scene, you'll hear her boyfriend, Andy, played by Ed Helms, trying to celebrate Erin for being the office secretary. You get pretty upset. That is, Erin gets pretty upset and throws a piece of cake in his face.
I know about Angela. I know that you were engaged to her and that you were sleeping with her. Michael told me.
Oh, God.
Erin, can we talk about this in private?
I don't want it to be in private. Is it true or is it not?
Yes.
Who else did you sleep with? Did you sleep with Phyllis or no. Kelly or Pam? Maybe all together?
No, no, never.
Did everyone know? Was I the only one who didn't know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much.
Oh. Who are you? I don't know you.
Like you're laughing as you're hearing this again.
The minute I just heard Steve Carell's voice, I was laughing. So he's like, oh, no. Okay. I love that episode, not only because I got to be in it a lot, but Mindy Kaling wrote that episode. And I love Mindy's scripts of The Office. I love everyone's script, but particularly Mindy's. And I got to have such a great story with Michael Scott in that episode. And it was like – I just remember we shot a lot of it on this Friday afternoon at a restaurant in Studio City, and I thought I could just, you know, not die right now, but I could stop working right now, and I would have had a successful time doing it because that was a real thrill.
Guys seem to have whatever the female equivalent is of a real bromance there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you and Mindy Kaling seem to really
– A cis man.
A cis man. Your characters seem to have a cheerfulness and almost immature appeal. What draws you to that kind of character?
Well, I get worried sometimes because I don't know if the writers are observing something in me that is, you know, that is immature or naive or rube-like. But I'm hoping that the character that comes out of that is an exaggerated version of me and not me exactly. But I do think it's something that I can channel and that I can zero in on when I'm portraying those characters. And I also like both Aaron Hannon and Kimmy Schmidt are they have tempers. Like when they
as we just saw, cake to the face.
Exactly. I was so nervous that day because I had to do that in front of the whole cast. And I felt like I was still sort of new, and that was nerve-wracking. So I think there's it's fun to play those moments when they become unhinged.
You mentioned that you wanted it to be personal, but not too personal in your memoir. Why the reserve?
Midwestern, I don't know. Catholic? I mean, that's so cliched. But I can't explain it. I want some privacy.
But there's something that's interesting where there's things about people who are propelled somehow in Hollywood and in entertainment. Like you want to be out there. Yeah. You want people to watch. You want the light on you. But there is a zone, right, that you don't want to go too far into. And you're still in the early years of this, right?
You're kind. I don't know if I'm in the early years. I'll tell you, I'm in the early years of social media. I just joined Instagram 2 weeks ago, and we're talking
Mazel tov.
Thank you. I'm right on time, right? It's just came out.
It just released.
It is insane. People share everything. I don't get it. I don't understand the world right now. But you're right. I mean, I think that nothing is private anymore. I think you sort of have to assume that anyone can know anything about you at any given time. And there is, I think, an eagerness to share those details. And I don't know if that's good or bad. I can't tell.
Is that sort of thing you talk about with Mindy Kaling or other folks you work with on that? Like how to manage this?
No, I haven't spoken. I talk to my husband about it sometimes, Michael. But I haven't spoken to him in years. His name is Michael Coleman, and he plays a prominent part in my book.
Well, part of what you say is that here's a guy who you relied on for your audition for Saturday Night Live, failed, but he's successful in the world of comedy writing, and the two of you ended up forging a relationship as a result.
That's exactly right. We got married.
Not a bad gig at all.
No.
We're sitting down with Ellie Kemper, the star of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. You probably know her from Bridesmaids and The Office. We're discussing her new memoir, My Squirrel Days. Happy to have her here. Stick around. We're going to have her after the break. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
Unbreakable, they alive, damn it, it's a miracle. Unbreakable, they alive, damn it, it's females on a storm.
Despite what your ears are telling you, this is On Point, and I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking with the actor and comedian Ellie Kemper about her new memoir, My Squirrel Days. We'll touch on the comedic topics and tougher ones, including the themes of surviving trauma and workplace harassment, and think a little bit about the ways we learn from sitcoms and their handling of burning issues. Here right across from me in studio here in New York City is, of course, the irrepressible Ellie Kemper, Emmy-nominated star of the Netflix original series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Right there, you heard the show's theme song. Kimmy Schmidt, it was, as you say in your book, and rightly so, it is a crazy pitch of a series. The two sentences, tell us the setup of what Kimmy Schmidt is and how she arrives in her, where she is when she arrives in our television.
It's insane. So the backstory of Kimmy is that she was kidnapped when she was 14 years old, held underground in a bunker for 15 years, and then rescued by the FBI where she is brought back into the world and decides to make a new start for herself in, of course, New York City. That's where we start. So, I mean, it gets a little crazier from there, but I mean, I certainly thought when I heard the idea for this show that someone somewhere was pranking me, because that doesn't seem like a sitcom to me.
No, it seems like the setup for an extremely tough drama.
That's
in some
exactly.
ways. You know,
yeah.
You could imagine HBO, you know, the guys who did The Wire doing this very differently.
Absolutely. And yet, Robert Carlock and Tina Fey made it into an extremely funny show.
So tell me about that, because the sets, the your outfits, like everything is incredibly bright, almost pastel, right?
Yeah.
And you could not be, as you mentioned earlier, you have a temper as in character.
Yeah.
But you could not be basically a more default sunny creature.
Oh, yeah. I love that about Kimmy, because she is sort of unabashedly girlish. She wears bright pink pastel pants, much to my, like, Ellie's chagrin, because I don't like those pink pants. But she wears bright pink pants. She wears floral shirts. She wears jewelry that says Kimmy. She's a very, very girlish person. And yet, at the same time, she is this fierce, tenacious warrior who has been through something unthinkable and so difficult that I can't actually imagine what that must have been like. And yet, she continues to choose to think the best in people. And that – it's mysterious to me. I don't know if you're born with that sort of tenacity or if you are forced to develop it during, you know, a test like the one she was put through. But I think it's remarkable, and she's an admirable, beyond admirable person.
Also very childish.
Yeah.
In the way she deals with people. In season one of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, her roommate and friend Titus tries to give her a goodbye hug on the first day of school.
Titus?
Don't be embarrassed if you're Titus.
What if the other uneducated adults see me?
Fine. I hope someday when you're a gay black man, you have a Kimmy that treats you like this. I love you. Don't get lice.
Truly, truly funny and, you know, endearing and loving. At the same time, there's an undercurrent of bleak in all this stuff. How do you look at this rather dark comedy with such cheerfulness?
I don't. I was very concerned about that, because the last thing you want to do is treat a subject as very serious as the one that Kimmy, the torture that she has undergone. You don't want to treat that in any way lightly, because there's nothing light about it. But you have to deal with it, because bad stuff happens in the world. So I think it is – so much of it is in the writing. So the writers take care of 99% of the work for us. And I think it's about in the show, I do think there are sharp turns where you'll be making a joke about something and then 90-degree turn and you're, you know, back to talking about the bunker. And I think that's just – I don't know. I think that's how life is. Something can be, fine and sunny one moment and then horrible and kind of hellish the next. And you have to navigate those times. So and was that – what a broad answer. I'm like, well, it reflects life, but it does.
Well, so this is obviously a show created by Tina Fey. Mm-hmm. It was done initially for NBC. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Robert Greenblatt, who's the head of entertainment at NBC, was like, this is great. I love it. I love your team. Wonderful. Let's sell this to Netflix and not put this on NBC. Like, there were qualms about this up front, right?
I thankfully don't know the conversations that took place, so I get to plead ignorance. But yes, it was originally slated to be on NBC. And again, you know, I think it
– But I mean, it speaks to that discomfort of, hey, we're doing a comedy about a girl who's been underground. And so, you know, in that clip that you heard where Titus is sending her off to school, she didn't get to complete high school.
Right.
And there's something very adolescent or immature about her. I mean, where would you be if you'd been, you know, held up until the age of 12 or something?
Well, you know, I'm alarmed because sometimes when Kimmy doesn't understand a pop culture reference or doesn't understand, you know, the way people in 2018 behave, I'm like, oh, I didn't know that either. And I'm worried because Ellie was not in a bunker for 15 years. I think I'm just a little out of it. But I don't know what I was doing when I
think
was
she may have
girls.
Gotten on Instagram before you did.
Honestly, I swear to you, she's on Instagram. I'm just like trailing behind. But I think that she is necessarily naive because about certain things, because she has been – her adolescence was stunted. It's arrested development, and she's coming out as a 29-year-old, even though I'm 38 in real life. No big deal.
Nicely done.
Thank you. But she's, you know – she missed out on a lot of stuff that she's only seeing for the first time now.
In a lot of ways, you guys sort of I wouldn't say that you head-on address, but you certainly come into contact with a lot of issues that people are working through and thinking about. There are a couple of episodes I'm thinking about in particular. Here's a clip from season 4 of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and you can hear Kimmy arguing with Fran. He's the leader of a men's rights group called the Innocence Project, played by Bobby Monahan.
You females have it so easy.
Excuse me?
Oh, please. Like, how come when your body makes milk, it's beautiful?
Well, as a woman, I can tell you it's not easy, breezy, beautiful, cover girl. It's tough. For tough. Barks has bite. Stupid soda trickery council.
I have been a junior salesman at Daryl's Bridal for 15 years. I have seen what females truly are. All you care about is the ring and the dress, and not one of you will go out with me!
Because the women who come in here are engaged.
But I also hit on their moms!
Man's making a point there.
He's making a very good point.
A very valid societal point. In another episode, coworkers accuse your character of sexual harassment, Kimmy Schmidt, of sexual harassment in the workplace. In this scene, you'll hear Kimmy attempting to soften the blow of firing an employee named Kabir. She touches his shoulders and then, I kid you not, she drops her pants in an attempt to demonstrate her own humiliation in the moment.
That's right.
I like you, Kabir. I like seeing you every day. But maybe work isn't the best place for that. Maybe our friendship belongs in the night hours. Do you get what I'm trying to say? Okay. I don't want you to feel embarrassed. Embarrassing stuff can happen to anyone.
Uh-oh! Would you look at that?
Uh-oh, would you look at that?
Her pants dropped.
Her pants dropped. So, Ellen Kemper, why are you guys dealing with Me Too that way?
Right. I think it sort of turns it on its head. I think that Kimmy is a lovable rube, but a rube. And in her attempt to make this employee feel better, and, you know, the only thing I think she can imagine is, well, they always said, you know, if you feel nervous, imagine the audience in their underpants. And so I'm going to humanize myself by dropping my pants in front of him. That is sexual harassment, and Kimmy gets in trouble for it. And it's so well-intentioned and so misunderstood that I felt sorry for her that that had to happen to her. But I think this rage that she feels, and in the first scene you played against the – how funny is Bobby in that scene,
he's
by
great.
The way? He's fantastic.
But genuinely outraged that no one will date him in the bridal show.
He has such a tough life as a white American man. Poor guy. The rage that Kimmy feels in that moment, I loved playing that because, sorry, but you guys
were the worst.
We're annoyed with you right now.
I've heard.
Yeah.
It's come up.
Has it?
Yes. On the show and off.
Yeah.
So, you know, comedically, it's very funny. On the other hand, are you giving the Charlie Roses a chance to say, I was just trying to make people comfortable. I wore terry cloth. What's so wrong with that?
Well, that's a good point. Well, we'll get the writers in here to answer that. I mean, I think, I don't know how to answer that. You are sort of, I mean, she has, I believe her intentions, but yeah, that's a little tough.
That's a little tough.
I mean, I don't think when you say, are you opening the door for a, you know, a guy to give that excuse. Yeah, I think everybody knows what's right and what's wrong.
If you pick up a copy of Ellie Kemper's book, My Squirrel Days, you'll probably come for the Steve Carell bagel anecdotes. You'll stay for the Lakshmi Singh shout outs. On the other hand, there you go. On the other hand, there's one point at which you talk about your stress, and you talk in the book about how you start to kind of lose muscle function in your arm.
Oh, gosh.
And like there's this whole thing, you're trying to zip up a dress. You're supposed to interview Carol Burnett. I'm sure not a hero or anything for the comedy world.
Did some Wikipedia research.
What was going on that made you so, I guess, anxious or stressed out?
I'm a high anxiety kind of person. And I remember, and I talk about this in the book, my older brother, John, who's 2 years older than I am, advising me when I was in seventh grade and he was in ninth grade, that if I took everything so seriously at this new school, I was going to burn out. And he's not wrong. And John is, by the way, very calm and takes things in stride. And I don't have that ability. And I wish that I did. And so that you're referring to is a moment, I think it was the second season of Kimmy Schmidt when I woke up and my right hand was just lame. It had gone lame. I couldn't move it. And I know why. It's because I'd worked myself into such a tizzy with I don't know. I can make a mountain out of any molehill. So that's something I'm very good at. And so, you know, I don't know what I would do in a truly stressful situation because I think I take the situation and I let it fill the world of stress rather than let the world dictate the stress.
That sounds
I'm not
totally
sure I'm going with
me.
It.
Yeah. Sure, but, yeah. But go right ahead.
Yeah, that where like any situation can be blown up.
Uh-huh.
I'm able to do that with anything. Hopefully during this interview it'll happen.
You're doing all right. No hives evident yet.
Yeah, but you've noticed I've stopped moving my right hand.
But so you get basically a security guard to zip up your dress and you
right.
go on stage at the Paley Center somewhere and you interview Carol Burnett. How do you get through that?
Well, that was I guess you enter a zone. I don't know if you've ever been anxious or anything. I feel like in that moment, I think everything's – you have to get through tough moments. So what do? I think you just bear down and you just get through it. And actually, sorry to be corny, but Kimmy has this mantra, take it 10 seconds at a time. And I really think that's very powerful because if you think in those small increments, tough things become manageable.
I'm talking with Ellie Kemper. You may have encountered her in the 2011 movie Bridesmaids, speaking of the need for encouragement, giving a pep talk to her co-bridesmaid Rita, played by Wendy McClendon Covey. They're both, shall we say, a little under the influence on a flight to Las Vegas for a bachelorette party.
I don't want you to be a big up like me.
How do you think I feel?
Like me. Now, you can still turn it around.
No, don't. You're more beautiful than Cinderella. You smell like pine needles and you have a face like sunshine.
True words.
Truer words. Never spoke.
Never spoke. So you talked a little earlier about having been in improv. How is it different to be in a big screen movie like this? How much liberty do you have to play around?
Well, in fact, that movie specifically actually did draw on a lot of improv. It was the brilliant Paul Feig directed it, and go see his movie, A Simple Favor. Judd Apatow.
Nice plug.
Okay, nice plug. I'm not in it. Judd Apatow was an executive producer on Bridesmaids, and I think that sense of, taking several takes or many takes and letting the actors kind of go take liberty with it is encouraged. And so that airplane scene where you just played the clip, so much of that was improvised. Melissa McCarthy in that scene, that's when she puts her leg up. Do you remember her leg goes up? It's so funny. And so there was actually –
the air marshal, I guess.
The air marshal.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing like it. And so many of those ladies were groundlings, and I think all of them were and had background in improv. So I think that sort of – I don't want to call it riffing, but I can't think of another word right now. I don't like that word, riff, but we were riffing.
You were riffing? Do you remember moments of yours that you were like, wow, I really was able to land that stayed in?
For me personally, when I'm meeting Annie, that's Kristen Wiig's character, for the first time, and I'm going on about how she doesn't have a husband, and I'm so sorry. I feel so sorry for her, but just that dialogue, I think, was kind of expanded. We riffed and it stayed in.
We'll talk a little bit after the break about what that inspired you to think about in terms of women in comedy. But what was it like to be surrounded by this rat pack of like strong female comedians?
It was incredible. And I didn't exactly understand what was happening at the time. You know, we filmed it in 2010. That's 8 years ago. I'm with these giants of comedy and feeling like I'm not sure I belong at this party, but I'm so glad that they're having me. And what was very cool about the whole experience is it's not like Annie Mumlow and Kristen Wiig, who wrote the script, I don't think set out with the intention to like light the world on fire with their feminist, you know, agenda. I think they wanted to write a story about something they felt close to, and it happened to be, mostly ladies. And I think that was very cool. They just wanted to make a funny and also heartfelt story. And also it happened to be about women.
Do you feel as though there's a progression that you can sort of identify in about a minute and a half before we have to go to break of when you point to the characters that you've had that have been breakout? Do you see any ways in which you've tweaked and done something a little different or tested yourself?
Yeah, I was very worried about it because all these characters are cheerful and have big, pale faces like me. So I was worried specifically about Kimmy Schmidt and making that very different from Erin Hannon because they are both these childlike, you know, kind of cheerful rubes. And I think that when you have more time, I think, to develop a character and to investigate that character, you learn new things about that character. I know that sounds very actory, but it's true. And Kimmy had such a rich and dark backstory that I think there was a lot to inform the character that she had become. And there were so many layers to that lady. So I think it's about understanding what the character has been through that is, you know, having an effect on the person they are that day.
And how did that distinguish a little bit from Erin?
I think she's tougher. I think she's seen darkness. She's seen like the worst of humanity, and I don't know how that can't not affect you.
In the person of John Hamm, as it turns out.
Yeah, right.
We're speaking with the Emmy-nominated actor Ellie Kemper about her journey from hardscrabble childhood, which was completely not hardscrabble in the Midwest, overcoming educations at Princeton and at Oxford to starring in the Netflix original series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. We're going out of this segment with the song Male Prima Donna by Ellie Kemper and Mindy Kaling's band Subtle Sexuality on the NBC show The Office, and I promise you there's nothing subtle about it. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Prima Donna, my rhymes bite like piranha, hotter than a sauna, straight out of Lackawanna.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We are talking with comedian and Emmy-nominated actor Ellie Kemper about her new memoir, My Squirrel Days. We're going to be talking in the coming minutes about her presence and amid a crop of really strong women in comedy, names that come to mind, among others, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Mindy Kaling. Ellie Kemper, star of the Netflix original series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, is with me in the studio. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
So I just want to pick up on something that we were talking about during the break, which is, where's the line? You guys joke about Me Too. You guys make clear her Kimmy Schmidt's feminist ire, you know, and also yet you have her be sort of the comedian doofus almost backing into being a complete sexual harasser in the workplace. How do you joke, you know, about something that's so serious?
I don't have the answer. And I have been struggling with that and sort of wondering about that every day, because it does seem like so much is changing in comedy, and you would never want to trivialize or belittle anyone's concern. And so I don't know where is the line between making a joke and making an observation. And so I think it's an enlightening time, and it's a powerful time, because ladies are feeling comfortable and secure in coming forward and revealing what has happened to them. And there's nothing more powerful than owning a truth like that. And I don't know. It's jokes that I think you could have made year ago or 2 years ago are no longer funny. And so trying to figure that out is—
Is that good or bad for you?
I mean, luckily, a lot of my humor does not go into, like, you know, that kind of material. So I'm not known for, like, my offensive, bold comedy. But I think that it is— when writing the book, I was very— my editor and I were very concerned with how something might come across. I wasn't writing a lot about, like, subjects that were enormously sensitive, but at the same time, something that you might just think, oh, I'm just rattling off a little joke, it might not be.
So from your standpoint, is it like Michael Jordan, who's like, look, I don't get involved in political stuff because Republicans buy sneakers just like Democrats, are basketball fans too? Or is it that you actually— – that's not where you want to speak publicly, that you just want to be sort of apart from that stuff?
Two things. Yes, I am the Michael Jordan of comedy.
Yes, I think that's
I think that's very—
it's your
clear
icon on the logo.
Yeah,
right? Exactly.
Yes. Thank you for recognizing that.
Sure.
And second— – yeah, I mean, it that does seem like a cop-out. I mean, if you can't not be involved in politics now. I mean, I don't mean you have to, you can't not be political now. It's too crazy and momentous a time. So I think you can't just say, oh, well, I'm not going to get involved. But I also think that a lot of people are talking to and with people who already agree with them. So I don't know how much I don't know how much to weigh in on that, because there—
that's
are
right—
a lot of people shouting.
In some ways, like, the last question on this I want to ask is, you know, do you think that Kimmy Schmidt ultimately, in the way it handled this, in addition to getting laughs, in addition to making sure the humor was pointed at Kimmy, you know, advanced a certain understanding of certain issues on this stuff? Or do you think that it's, hey, we're here to make people laugh even if it's in a funny circumstance and that's what we're here to do?
I think there was definitely a feminist intention when especially when writing this season 4. And again, I'm not in the writer's room, so I don't want to speak for them, but I don't think it was just about trying to make— I mean, that's what's so insane to me and why these guys are magicians, is because they're able to make these points, both political and feminist points, while also keeping, like, jokes that are pristine and just so sharp and funny in the show at the same time. But I think it's too crazy a time to avoid that.
Now, we played a little bit earlier a clip from Bridesmaids, which itself was really funny and at times quite raunchy.
Yeah.
And it stirred in, apparently, you said, you shared, questions about women and comedy. You gave a talk in St. Louis, I guess the Archway TEDx talks or—
yes—
something in—
yeah—
2014. You took on the question that you had said that you'd been asked not just by fans, but by reporters. And the question was, are women funny?
Are women funny? Yes. Some women are funny. And no, some women aren't funny, right? It's similar to how some women are tall, and, you know, some women are short. It's like how some women like to ride the train while others prefer to take the bus. Women are different.
They are.
Apparently, the women different from one another is what you're saying, as well as from men.
Right. I think— no. Women are different from one— in that excerpt, I am talking about women are all sorts of different things.
Right.
And no, not one group of people is always going to be funny or not funny.
So, but I mean, you actually were inspired to give a talk on the basis of, you know, a meathead question from reporters.
Thanks,
because,
yes,
you know, on these tours, I assume you have to have a lot of, you know, questions.
Right.
Hopefully some of them less meathead than others.
Yeah, but I think that— – so when Bridesmaids came out, I think, okay, well, that is— – I don't know if reporters have a conference or what happens, but everyone decided, like, okay, we're going to talk about the fact that they made a movie that was successful, and yet it's still just women. And I think that was— – so that was the question that was in the water. Okay, so women can be funny. But I have— – being honest— – I never had a thought that women weren't funny. I think it was based on the box office success of Bridesmaids that it demonstrated to studios that you can make a very funny comedy starring all women and it'll make money. So on that side, of course, it's great that was successful financially. But this idea, and it's asked by men and women that, you know, are women funny, is so stupid, because what are you talking about? Yeah, they've always been funny.
And you went after the late Christopher Hitchens, who's a noted British and intentional controversialist who—
yeah—
basically wrote this thing for Vanity Fair saying, essentially, obviously women are not funny and they don't need to be. Was that something that you encountered when you were trying out for things? I mean, in the 2000s, was that still a thing?
I never encountered that, and I know some women have. In improv, and again, I said I did a lot of stuff at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and the People's Improv Theater, I never ever encountered any unfairness or hostility because I was a woman. I think that a lot of that stuff comes from – when I have encountered it, it's from listen, it's from white guys in other industries who are seem surprised. Like, I got a lot of emails from some people I went to college with who work maybe in the financial sector who were impressed that the movie was funny. And I thought, get out of my inbox because I know it's funny. And they were the fact that they were surprised made me furious because it also reminded me that not everyone thinks the way my comedy friends and I think, which is that it's not an issue. Like, someone is in a sketch or is in a movie or is in a television show because they're either funny or they're not.
So you sent a note back saying congrats on the fact that apparently white guys can sometimes make money.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Sometimes.
You work with some real giants here, as we mentioned. You work with Tina Fey, Mindy Kaling, Kristen Wiig. What did you learn? What do you take from working with somebody like Tina Fey, who really has sort of – I think publicly tried to articulate how she's tried to model things for women comedians and be like, you know, you got to be tough and you got to stand up for what you believe. You know, what did you take from working with her?
That what you just said, which is most of the lessons I learned from Tina Fey were just by watching her, because that woman leads by example and she doesn't complain and she works tirelessly and she treats everyone fairly and kindly. And she's very grounded. So I think that there's she empowers women by doing. She just she talks about it, but she also just does it. And so
walk us through what that means a little bit for listeners who may not have followed her as closely as you have.
Well, I guess it means that it's not like it's a constant thing. Like, I mean, I've read Bossy Pants 15 times. I mean, it's brilliant.
Her best-selling book,
which is just brilliant, and she talks about this in her book, Being the Boss. And there's something in her introduction where she says that she gets asked a lot, like, what's it like being in charge of all those people? And she compares it to, she says, oh, it's like, it must be like when people ask Donald Trump, hey, how's it feel to be in charge? This is before Donald Trump was president, by the way. And her point being that nobody's asking Donald Trump that, although people should be asking that question. But it's because she's –
I think people are now. Different show, different book.
But the fact that – she would be asked that question, I think, was so perplexing because just the double standard there. And I was not the boss of our show. I was not running the show. But I think that there is we should read that book to get guidance on and her experience being in charge of projects, because I think it talks about her management style and how you become a good boss, but also not to be naive about it. Like, I think there is a different standard for women, and that's unfortunate, but there is. So, but again, I think most of it is, I think that you can get a lot done just by doing the work.
But just by showing up and doing the work.
Yeah, and not making an issue about it, just doing it, yeah.
In the book you write, I mentioned earlier about Carol Burnett, you write a little bit about other figures, including Kaling, Kristen Wiig, Amy Poehler. You give a couple shout-outs to, although I don't think the two of you have worked together.
We did. I just remembered it.
Dope. What?
No, because – and they came together. I just remember – and they came together, which is a David Wayne movie. I was in one scene, and so I got to sit across the table from her. So, yes, we have been in one.
You absorbed that magic.
Oh.
And I think you may have tried out for Parks and Rec. Is that right?
Yeah. I think originally that's what I was auditioning for before The Office. So –
well, but it seems to have worked out for you nonetheless. Are there folks that just comedically you kind of look to for inspiration, whether current or past ones?
I love yes, there are so many women. I want to say that my favorite show for so long was The Mindy Project. I'm sad it's off. I think that show is so funny. And it's so Mindy. It's her voice. Singular Mindy. I love it. The jokes are so good on that show. Growing up, I loved Seinfeld. And people will ask, oh, well, you love Seinfeld. What was it about the Elaine character that you loved? What I loved is that it wasn't an issue that she – I mean, when people talk about being a woman in comedy and succeeding in spite of that, it's – again, that's the part that is so – why are you bringing up that she was a woman? I never thought twice about the fact that Elaine was a woman. She was just in the gang with the rest of them. But Seinfeld was probably the show we watched the most growing up.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, one of the things I loved about it was none of them were redeemable.
None of them.
Elaine was no softer than the guys.
I loved that. And I loved watching, as I mentioned, I'm from the Midwest. Maybe we're a little polite there. I loved watching this lady who would get mad, who would shove people, who would, you know, not always be polite, even though she sometimes aimed to be. But no, they were all sort of unlikable.
She was brutal to George.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she was tough. She was a very tough comedic character.
And that was cool to see.
Are there male characters you look to for inspiration, or that, you know, actors, comic actors or comedians that you're like, you know, I'll pull a little bit of that there?
Do you know who I I'll just say who makes me laugh is John Mulaney. I think he's so – and Nick Kroll. I think those guys are so funny. Ike Barinholtz, who's on Mindy Project, is hilarious. There's so much. It's not often that you laugh out loud, but those guys always make me laugh out loud.
Ellie Kemper, you were, if I recall correctly, an intern at Conan O'Brien's show, I think back when he was on NBC, correct?
That's right.
The alumni roster there is insane. What's with the culture there?
I don't know. Yeah, a lot of people from The Office came from there. Mindy interned there, John Krasinski, Angela Kinsey, I think everyone interned there. I don't know what that is. I have no idea what that is.
But he's like sorry to interrupt, but he like inspires a certain kind of loyalty from folks who've worked for him, and also my sense is from people in the world of comedy, even if he, you know, isn't the Tonight Show host or isn't something else, like people look at him and say, this guy really has a sense of who he is. What is it about Conan?
About Conan? He's a genius. He is so smart. If ever I am a guest on his show, I am so nervous because—
This is because of the Princeton insecurity about Harvard?
Maybe.
Is that what it is?
Maybe. Just his, oh, he knows everything there is to know about history. I mean, he's actually a genius. And so that's intimidating. I'm not a genius. I'm smart, but I'm not a genius. So, but I think everyone, I mean, when you're good, you're good. So of course the reverence for him is just, that's never going to end.
Is there a certain, like, you know, look, you mentioned Judd Apatow, the director and producer earlier, and he's got kind of a school, you know, of how he does comedy.
Yeah.
Is there a school that you kind of think of yourself, well, kind of part of this circle or that circle?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know. I want to be a member of all of the schools. I think, I guess I don't know. I would maybe categorize it as the Upright Citizens Brigade because that's where I trained. And
so let's talk about that for a moment. That's based here in New York. Yeah. There is also one out in L.A., right?
Mm-hmm,
and that's an improv place where people take classes, and then if they can ascend the ranks and end up performing for a little bit to the public, and then they're doing it for the real public. But the real public, of course, are the Lorne Michaels and the Judd Apatows of the world, right?
Yeah. I mean, that school has exploded. So when I signed up to take classes, there was no problem getting in. And now I think you have to enter a lottery and sign up on, you know, Mondays at 2 p.m. or you'll never get a chance. And the training there was unmatched. I mean, I learned so much going through the classes there. And there are so many opportunities. I mean, it gives you a place to put up your own work and then people can come and see what you can do.
In about the minute that we have left, what is it that improv allows you to do or forces you to think about as a comic actor?
It forces you to think about the whole, that's the whole, and not necessarily yourself, which this will sound very corny, but I think it's a good note to end on, which is that it's all about the ensemble in improv. And so if you're promoting yourself, it's not going to be very funny. And so I think that is the central tenet of improv, which is yes and you're sort of serving the community.
Yes and being what? Remind people.
Not everyone here is an improviser. Yes.
They're all waiting on waiting lists.
Yeah. They couldn't get in. Yes is you accept what your scene, the reality that your scene partner gave you, and you add to it. And you add to it. So you don't negate what someone says. You take what they have offered and you build on it. And I think I love that as sort of a good lesson for, you know, a more global, in a more global sense, because I told you it was going to be corny, but that's sort of what you have to do to have a successful society. You have to build on what you give each other.
Yes, and we've been yes-anding with Ellie Kemper, star of the Netflix original series Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which is itself kind of a weird improv proposition. Young woman's been in a bunker for years, and she goes to New York City to figure out her life.
Yes.
Ellie Kemper is also author of the new memoir, My Squirrel Days. Ellie Kemper, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I had a blast.
Awesome. You can continue our conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuillan, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo, Justine Daum, and Lexi Puri. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.